Welcome to the weekly sermon podcast of Valley Grove Baptist Church. We are thankful you stopped by to hear from God's Word, to grow closer to Him, and to be inspired to reach your area of influence. Your Bibles this morning, let's go ahead and open to Revelation chapter 13. I tell you, this week I was looking back through, because one of the points that we're going to make today here in the beginning as we begin talking about Revelation 13, I was able to go back in my notes because my kind of little insight into how all this works before we get to today is whenever we're doing a long series, if the document doesn't get too big, sometimes it's kind of hard to bring up on certain things, and so depending on how fast your computer is or whatever, and so I'll just, my notes are all in one document, so it gets pretty lengthy by the time you get to the end. We're about the halfway point right now about how I had this thing, like maybe a little bit past halfway, but I had to go back and look at something I had said earlier to make sure what I was going to say today was accurate to what I had said earlier, and the statement that I'm going to make later in a minute, I look back and we started this sucker on February 4th, right? It's kind of hard to, It's probably, going to take us a few more weeks. It'll be about Thanksgiving by the time. I'm hoping we're done by Christmas, you know, or when you know, you traditionally start preaching Christmassy messages. But it'll be at least probably till Thanksgiving, depends on how some of these lay out. But it reminded me, the flowers today, seeing the fall colors, we're thankful for those and for those who gave those in honor of you and others. And so, you know, it just reminds us of how God weaves in and out through our lives and the seasons and how things change, but His Word never changes no matter where we're at or what season we're going into. And so it reminded me of another story I told somebody today that which we'll be going through here in a little bit. I never really got into that fall. This has nothing to do with Revelation 13, but you know, it just feels like that kind of day. And I promise I'll get us to lunch, okay? I did charge my watch today to make sure I got you out of here on time. But it reminded me, and then seeing the colors this morning, it reminded me of, you know, I never really got into the fall, you know, going to see the leaves thing. You know, because I grew up in South Georgia, or Middle Georgia, and we hunted in South Georgia. There's two fall colors. And I don't know if you've ever lived in South Georgia, but there's only two fall colors in South Georgia. Green and brown. That's it. You've got pine trees that are green, and every other leaves are brown. And, you know, somebody around the road may have planted a maple tree in their yard that's got some color. Other than that, it's green and brown. So I never really got into the going to see the leaves until Holly was pregnant with Tucker, and my mom and dad had a camper, like a pull-behind camper, and they wanted to go to the mountains. And so we were like, this is probably our last hurrah before the baby comes. And so about this time of year, probably in October-ish, around her birthday, we go up to the mountains. And we're at Track Rock Park, which is way up there near Blairsville. And, you know, we got there late at night. It was after church on Wednesday. We drove up, so you couldn't see anything. And then we woke up the next day, and it was a plethora of colors on the side of the mountain. And then every day we were there, it got more and more and more and more colors. Like they started up high, and it was really cool. You could see it all go down. Anyway, and so that don't have nothing to do with anything. I just think it's really cool how God does all that and how He weaves it into our year to remind us of Him in every season and the things, you know, in the spring it's stuff popping up and all that kind of stuff. Anyway, all right, on to Revelation 13. That was free, by the way. You know, whatever you want to call that. All right, Revelation 13. As we turn the page to this chapter, we're moving into the second kind of chapter or second act in the play that began last week. So I told you last week with Revelation 12, it kind of opens up kind of this new cycle called the cycle of the dragon or the dragon cycle. And so that was the first act in the play, chapter 12. This is the second act in the play. We're not going to be able to look at the whole chapter today because We got to do a little background work. Now, I'm going to give you a quiz here right at the beginning. And you just think, some of you will know it. Hopefully, we all need to know it, okay? But some of you will probably be able to get it right off the bat. All right, we talk a lot about context, and we make a statement around context. Context is... Wow, way to go, guys. Let's say it all together. Context is king, right? Context is king. Say it all together. Context is king. All right. Whenever you read the Bible, in fact, I would say there's a lot of things in life where that's true as well, right? Context is always king. What I mean by that statement and what we mean when we come to the Bible is that you and I don't get to import our own meaning into the Bible, but rather we have to let the context of the Bible define the parameters in which we talk about it. So for example, back many weeks ago when we talked about one of the seals or the trumpets, and there's those like locusty scorpion things and all that, it's funny because I watched a video on YouTube that was talking about that passage, and you know what they showed when the guy is talking about that passage? An Apache helicopter shooting missiles. And I'm like, no, dog, that is not correct. Why? Because John, that has no relevance for John and his early readers, right? Okay, no relevance. That is an example of us importing meaning into the text. So context is always king. And so the reason we're not going to do all of chapter 13 today is because we got to talk about four contextual issues that come up in this chapter that if you and I are not aware of, we potentially will grossly miss the point of chapter 13. Okay. Now, two of the issues, they're all on your outline. Two of the issues we've talked about before. And so I want to just touch those rather briefly. The other two we'll spend a little more time on. Here's the first one. The first one is the imperial cult. We said all the way, but this is the point I had to go look back. We said on February 4th that one of the background issues, one of the context issues for the entire chapter, for the entire book of Revelation, is Roman imperialism and Roman domination and the imperial cult that comes along with it. What I mean by imperial cult is part of the fabric that was woven into Roman society was that by the time that John writes his letter, it was a well-established tradition that you would worship the emperors as God or as a god. In other words, it would be like, pick a president, JFK. It would be like, since JFK, every president after that, there's a statue, and while that person's alive and after that person's alive, you're all required to go offer a sacrifice because that president is viewed as a god. Now that sounds really weird to you and I, right? But that was woven into the fabric of the day. Right? It was so woven into the fabric of the day that every aspect of I won't say every aspect, but almost all aspects of life, there were images or sayings or art that portrayed that picture. I've got a book that I've been reading written by one of my professors. It's really cool. I meant to share the link already. He's actually doing a talk tomorrow night from about 6 to 8 at a university down in South Mississippi about this topic, about Revelation, reading Revelation through political and cultural lenses or whatever. Fascinating, right? And in his book, he goes into great detail about how Rome lined the streets, like the major thoroughfares of cities, with images of Roman imperialism, Roman dominance. Wow. Spam call. Great. Boy, I tell you what. All right, well, here we go, right? And so these streets were lined. I'm never going to get y'all back. All right, go. Here we go. It's like the one time I was preaching and a rat ran across the room. I mean, not a mouse, like not this, like... with a bunch of teenage girls and boys. They were all on top of the tables trying to get away from the rat. Anyway, all right, so let's gather back. Here we go. All right, so everything in culture was woven together where it was a part of even the economics. So coins, stamped. Like ours, but they would have insignia around them about the emperor or imperialism or Rome, right? Economics played into so much, and here's the other point that we've talked about that weaves into chapter 13 is trade guilds. So we talked about that when we were talking about in chapter 2 and 3. We mentioned when we spoke about the city of Thyatira that ancient historians or archaeologists have noted that in the city of Thyatira, which one of the seven letters goes to, had more trade guilds than any other city in Asia Minor. Trade guilds were like, if you wanted, back in that culture, most of the people made money and made a living by doing things with their hands. And so you might be a weaver or a silversmith or a goldsmith or a tanner or any number of things. But in order to sell your goods, you had to be a part of the trade guild. So everybody who did copper work was a part of the coppersmith's trade guild. So that if whatever they made, it helped them set like a price per item, so that, you know, one person wasn't trying to undercut everybody else, but it also gave them legitimacy that if you were a part of the guild, then you were the accepted sellers and workers, and you were approved by the state to do this. That's kind of like licensure today, right? In certain areas, in certain fields, you have to have and keep a license in order to practice that. Well, imagine in today's culture, if you wanted to be the guy who cuts your hair, right? They have to have a license to do that. Well, imagine if in order to do that, they had to go give an offering to the governor and the president every year. I mean, what? But that's what they were doing. They would have these guild meetings, like, you know, every, say, once a quarter or once every month, and it would be a big party. And part of the party and part of the feast was you made an offering, a literal offering to the emperor as God. That may be a pinch of incense here or there, but that becomes a really sticky point real quick, doesn't it? On multiple levels. Because for Christians, because A, I got to support my family, but B, I'm worshiping the emperor as God, and so what do? Right? Well, Jesus talks about that in Revelation 2 and chapters 2 and 3 to the letters to the church. You can go back and listen to those, right? We discuss those. So those are two things that weave in and in this, okay? And you'll see, the trade guilds doesn't come up till next week, all right? The one today will come up today. First one will come today. Now, here's the two we haven't talked about that we need to talk about this morning. First is John's use of Daniel 7. Now, when we read the passages about the images of the beasts, because in chapter 13 there's the beast of the sea and the beast of the land, you will hear fantastical language that is absolutely in line with apocalyptic literature. But today what we'll see is that John takes Daniel. I got a chart on your outline. Look at the chart. You can look at the chart. We talked about this about 3 years ago when we preached through Daniel. I think those sermons may actually still be on our website if you comb back through the files. And you can go listen to the audio of those if they're still up. But when we talked about those, what we noticed in your chart, your outline on your handout shows that Daniel sees this vision of these beasts, one right after the other. And what we talked about then is that they represent successive empires. Well, what John does is he takes that image, all of those images, and smashes them together into one image. And so it's like he's taking stock ideas that would have been known to some of the readers and puts them all together into one terrifying image. Now, the other thing that John does is if you read in chapter 7 and then in chapter 9, I believe, chapter 7, chapter 9 of Daniel, Daniel makes the epitome of all that is anti-God, someone who is in the, listen to me real carefully, someone who is in the future for him, but would be in the past for John. Okay? And that we noted then, and we'll note again today, that that epitome of, to quote George W. Bush, the axis of evil, rested on the guy, and his name was Antiochus Epiphanes. Okay? That was the dude. Right? And historically, we kind of can connect dots. That's the guy. He's the axis of evil for Daniel. What John does is he takes that idea of the beasts, smashes them together, and creates one image in Revelation, and then in Revelation 13 takes that idea of the axis of evil, but he transforms it not into a past tense person, but into a present tense person for them. Okay? Now, I know you're going to ask the question, and you should ask the question, but I thought this related to the future, and how does it connect the dots for us today? All right, you got to hang on to that question, and I'm going to be honest with you, you got to come back next week, okay? Because we're going to kind of hit that one in more detail next week, all right? But John, in other words, is taking, let's capture it all together, he's taking stock images that were known in the culture among Jews and believers and using them to fit the present situation. Okay? We clear? As mud? As my grandma used to say. We're together. We'll flesh it out a little bit more. Now, here's the fourth thing you need to know. All right? Because context is king. All right? And this one you may not be aware of, but by the time I get through done with it, you'll be aware of it. Okay? And so, it's cool if you don't know about it. There's another aspect that'll especially come up today, and it's this legend. It's a Roman legend that was very popular at the time in which John was writing. The technical name for it is Nero Redivivus, which simply means Nero reborn or Nero resurrected. Right? Now, Nero was a terrible tyrant, despot king, or emperor of Rome, who ruled in like the 60s. He's probably the emperor which put to death Peter and Paul. They most likely die in Rome around 62, 63, 64. That's when Nero is still reigning. And there's this great fire that happens in Nero's reign. Some people say that Nero started it. Most historians today say, no, he didn't. But whatever, however the fire, the great fire of Rome, it devastated much of Rome. And so somebody's got to be blamed for the fire, right? It's somebody's fault. Well, Nero decides to blame it on the Jews and specifically the Christians. And so there was a great persecution of Christians after the great fire. And in fact, most historians, or some historians specifically, Christian historians have noted that after the great fire of Rome, Nero would, listen to me now, would take the bodies of dead, or take the bodies of Christians, and would use them to light fires for parties he had in his gardens. Right? On the regular, would do that. Nero was hated, he eventually dies, but almost as soon as he dies, up comes the idea of Nero Redivivus or Nero Reborn, that either A, he hadn't really died, or there will be a day when Nero will come back to life and will rule again with an iron rod. Right? That's the idea. And here in a minute, you'll see that's some of the background of how this beast is pictured. Now, that may really sound weird to you and I, but might I remind you, if you grew up in the late 90s and early 2000s, we experienced this as a culture. Come on, y'all know it. Tupac's alive. He's not dead. How does a dead man release records after he's dead? I don't know. Right? But for decades, there were people who purported that Tupac, still today, he's alive somewhere. Right? You know? Well, in the same way, that's what was being said about Nero between his death in the 60s and when John writes in the 90s. All right, so those four things, you got to keep those in the back of your mind. They serve as backgrounds to what we're going to read today. All right, let's read a few verses. And I saw a beast rising out of the sea. Now, right there, let's stop right there. The sea in John's day was a place of uncertainty, of unknown. Monsters were in the sea. It was, you think of Moby Dick. I mean, if you've watched Pirates of the Caribbean, the Kraken, right? Still to this day, there's this kind of this weird stuff out there in the sea. Even today, it's the most unexplored part of our... We know more about the heavens and the earth than we do about the sea, right? And so this image would have immediately told the readers, oh, this is going to be bad. All right. And I saw a beast rising out of the sea with 10 horns and 7 heads, with 10 crowns, diadems or crowns, on its horns and blasphemous names on its heads. Now, a lot of people try to make a lot of hay about the 7 horns and heads and all of that and crowns. Hold that. We're not going to make hay out of any of that today because I think that kind of misses the overall point. Now, when we read chapter 17, some of this will kind of come to light. You got to hold your breath till we get there. Verse 2. And the beast that I saw was like a leopard. Its feet were like a bear's, and its mouth was like a lion. And to it, the dragon gave his power and his throne and great authority. Okay, so there's all your descriptions of the beast. So it's a conglomeration of Daniel 7, which is a terrifying image. Now, verse 3. One of its heads... All right, listen to the words. One of its heads seemed to have a mortal wound. That word mortal is the same Greek word for death. So you can read it. One of its heads seemed to have a death wound, a wound leading to death. Right? So what is it? What is this verse 3, first part of verse 3 saying? That in some way this beast died. Okay? But its death wound was healed. What does that mean? Came back to life. Right? So there John's weaving in this thing of Nero. All right, this idea that leaders can die and come back to life. And what happened? And the whole earth marveled as they followed the beast. Now, one thing real quick, because we're going to talk about this more in the next verse. Whenever John talks about the whole earth in Revelation, he's not speaking about literally every single person on the earth. Whole earth is a term that is used to describe those who do not follow Jesus. Okay? So think of this as everyone who doesn't follow Jesus. They followed after the beast. All right, verse 4. And they, that's those who don't love Jesus, they worshiped the dragon. Now, why do they worship the dragon? Because he, the dragon, had given his authority to the beast. All right, so what's going on here? Let's stop for a minute. So there's this terrifying person, because remember, it's not literally a seven-headed animal, okay? Remember, this is a metaphor. It's a person who has all of the imagery of a terrible person. And who is that person associated with? Not with God in heaven, but with who? The dragon, who we said last week is Satan. So this, whoever this person is associated with Satan. All right, so they worship the Satan because they're worshiping his pawn. Put it that way. All right. And they worship the beast saying, who is like the beast and who can fight against it? Now, this is what would have been said about the Roman legions. I mean, like, seriously. They conquered the known world at this time. The empire was at its height 720 to 20, 30 years after John writes this. Nobody could stop the Romans. Right? There's only one group who could, and they lived way out in the east. Way out there. So, I mean, like, who's going to stop us? Nobody. That's kind of the answer. All right, verse 5. Now, here's what the beast does. So, we're going to read all the way through to verse number 8, and then we'll come back and talk about it. And the beast was given a mouth uttering haughty and blasphemous words, and it was allowed to exercise authority for 42 months. Verse 6. And it opened its mouth to utter blasphemies against God, blaspheming His name and His dwelling, that is, those who dwell in heaven. Verse 7. Also, it was allowed to make war on the saints and to conquer them, and authority was given it over every tribe and people and language and tongue. (Clears throat) and all who dwell on the earth will worship it. Everyone whose name has not been written before the foundation of the world in the book of life of the Lamb who was slain. All right, let's stop right there. Because in verses 5 through 8, what we read is the action or the agenda of the beast. So he's described in the first three verses, right? He's described in this terrific in the terrible sense of the word as this terrible beast. But remember, that's a metaphor for a person who's given authority through Satan's power, and he is a pawn for Satan, and the world goes after him because he's supposedly dead and then comes back to life. And so what does he do, though? Well, there's three words, I think, that kind of summarize verses 5 through 8, and that is, listen to me, that is worship, words, and war. Three W's. Worship, words, and war. Let's talk about worship first. This entire apparatus in chapter 13, if you wanted to summarize chapter 13, it would be one word: worship. Not worship of God, though, but of worship that is everything anti-God. Right? See, this entire apparatus of the beast of the sea and the beast of the land, which we'll talk about next week, is all about getting people to worship Satan, not worship God. Right? That's the whole point. That is the entire agenda. The entire agenda is to push people to worship the beast and thereby worship Satan. Now, that statement, who is like the beast and who can fight against it, what does that tell us? And again, that might have been in culture used of the legions, but what does it mean for the beast? It means that he will have remarkable influence. I mean, how do you get the entire world to follow after somebody? You got to have influence, right? I was once told, it was in a conversation about leadership, and the guy said, hey, everybody wants to be a leader, right? You know, you want to be a leader. You want to be a leader. But if you're leading and you turn around and nobody's following you, then you're not really leading, right? And he said one of the ways you get people to follow is you got to have influence in their life. Well, if you're going to get the whole world that doesn't love Jesus, which is a lot of people, to not follow God but to follow you, you better have some influence, right? So whoever this is referring to has got to have influence. What else does it tell us about the beast? It also tells us about people. It's that people are easily fooled through propaganda. Right? These chapters are laden, especially 13, are laden with propaganda that would have been current to the time of Rome. And what does it tell us? People, just like us, are easily fooled. Right, that's why in verse number 9, which we'll talk about kind of at the end. What does it say in verse number 9? If anyone has ears, let him hear. If anyone has, Jesus says a bunch of the parables. He who has ears to hear, let him hear. Why? Because you and I are easily fooled by smooth talk and flashy signs. Are we not? Come on, all of us. And so what does this passage tell us? One of the overarching things it tells us is that the beast will have, whoever this is, will have great influence. But also people are easily fooled through propaganda because they're unwilling to see and to hear what the truth really is. All right, so that's the worship. Worship is the goal. That's the entire goal of this. Not worship of God. This is not to drive people to worship the true God, but it is worship that is meant to be driven to drive people away from God. But there's also words. Now, there's two things that John, two descriptive, in verse number 5, descriptive words that John used to describe the words that the beast will say. They're haughty and blasphemous. The word haughty means boasting of one's own importance, and blasphemous means to be defaming, insulting, or slanderous. Right? Haughty means that in some sense the words are haughty words are words that build you up and your own importance up at the demise of other people. We've all met those kind of people, right? Who their accomplishments are always better than your accomplishments, and they can't just celebrate your accomplishments. They've always got to, we call them one-uppers. You know those people, right? You've got this great story, but they've, oh man, you better wait till you hear this one. And it's like, okay, right? That's haughty language. Blasphemy is defaming language and putting people down. So at the same time that this, the language that the beast is given is to build him and the dragon or Satan up and to push others down. Now there's specific targets to this, right? In verse number 5, it tells us the targets of this language, of these words. It is God, big G, in heaven, and saints. You and I who followed it after Jesus. The original readers of this letter in the seven churches who followed after the Lord. They're the targets of this haughty, defaming language. So it's what do we see again? We keep coming back to this thing. That Revelation is not a book of sword, literal swords, but is a book of words. Right? That words are the battlefield. Not swords and guns, shields and tanks and all that, but words. And so what does the beast use to try to defeat God in heaven and his believers on earth? Words. Right? Words. But when words don't work, what do you go to next? War. What does the verse tell us? What does the verse tell us? Right? In verse number 7. Also, it was allowed, the beast was allowed to make war on the saints. That's battle, right? To battle the saints. And the word conquer there in verse 7 means to be victorious. And to conquer them. And it was given, and an authority was given it over every tribe and people and language. So what does that mean? Excuse me. It means that in some way, the beast of the sea will have the ability to win a victory, whether it would be social, cultural, or economic in nature. And there are biblical examples of how this worked. We mentioned one last week. Remember we talked about Pharaoh last week? And I think it was last week. And how Pharaoh, when he got mad, Moses kept coming up and saying, let my people go. And all the plagues started happening. And he got mad and he said, oh Israelites, you're going to have to keep making the same number of bricks, but we're not bringing you the straw. You got to go out and get the straw to then continue to make your bricks at the same rate, at the same number, or else there's a cost to pay. That's a form of this, right? In some sense, that is a victory for Pharaoh. Now, it is a small one compared to what happens in the end, right? We see this in the book of Acts. Go read the book of Acts. What you will find is that John's own brother, James, was the leader of the Jerusalem church until he had his head cut off. And what happened? Historians call it the dispersion. Believers left Jerusalem en masse and went poof. Which in some sense was a battle victory for the religious elite in Israel, in Jerusalem. But it ended up being their defeat because as Christians spread, more people became Christ followers. Right? That's how you and I are here today in some macro sense. Not because of that one event, but because of events just like that. And so the same thing goes on. So, what are the tactics of the beast? Worship is the goal, words are the weapon, and if we can't get that done, it will be war. Now, we have a great historical example of these three things being played out again in the book of Daniel. And you probably know the story because we have been telling this story in Bible school since Bible school was invented. Right? And it's the story of the fiery furnace. Right? What happens? King Nebuchadnezzar builds a statue out of gold. Most people think it's probably a statue of himself. He builds a statue on the plain. You can go read it. Builds this great, so calls all the people together. And says, when you hear all the musical instruments, and they list a bunch of musical instruments, you are to bow down and do what? Clap. worship the image. What's the goal of the golden image? To look pretty? No, sir. It is about worship. And it is getting everybody not to worship the true God, but to worship a false God. And then what does Nebuchadnezzar do when Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego don't worship? Words. Hey guys, y'all come up here. It's been said to me, and he was angry. The text tells you, he was hot with anger. Calls him and says, what's this I hear? Y'all, when da-da-da-da-da instruments were played, you didn't bow down. And what do Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego say? Hey, let me go get my sword out of my pocket. We about to duel? No. What do they say? Oh, Nebuchadnezzar. Paraphrasing here loosely. Let it be known to you today that we may not make it out of this alive, but we will never bow down and worship the golden image. And what does Nebuchadnezzar do? Well, words didn't work. So what's it? Come on, y'all know the story. What's he do? Heats the furnace up 7 times hotter, so hot that when they take Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego and throw them in the furnace, that one of the throwers of them in the furnace, he dies because it's so hot. And then what happens to them when they're in the furnace? Nebuchadnezzar is watching them. I've always tried to picture this as a kid, like how did he see them in there? Anyway, was there a glass door? Like, how did he see them? Anyway, he sees them in there, and he asks the thrower in theirs of, hey, didn't we just throw 3 people in? As if he just forgot. And the guy says, yeah, we did. And he says, well, why do I see 4 and one lot looks like the Son of Man or the Son of God? And then what happens? Somehow they cool the fire down really quickly. I don't know. And then they get Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego out. And what does the text tell us? Not a hair on their body was singed. Right? And then Nebuchadnezzar.